Okay, this is continuing with Bill Ellis on 10 March 78. Yes.
This paper was a theoretical one, showing that the... Let me put it another way. The absorption in the direction of the galactic center indicated that there was a disk-like distribution. The paper actually was not one attempting to account for the high-resolution observations, but was actually showing that a it was tackling it from the other point of view, in other words, from the theory first, and
yes,
showing that a disk-like distribution of ionization would produce a cutoff in the low frequency spectrum, and accounted for the low angular resolution spectra observed in 55 and 62.
Without a halo?
This is a pure disk. Just a disk with emission outside the disk and inside the disk. But the distribution of the emission outside the disk was omnidirectional, could be extragalactic. You made no assumptions about that. What it did show was that such a distribution would naturally lead to the low frequency cutoff in the spectrum.
Right.
There was no reference to the high angular resolution observations, which were then just at that time starting to produce an actual map of the distribution.
Mm-hmm.
But the existence of those observations, looking at the chart records, made it quite clear that the theoretical paper on the spectrum was firmly based, mm-hmm, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Whereas people couldn't come along and say you've exceeded the reasonable extrapolation, or you've extrapolated too far from the observations, because we knew we had behind us these other unpublished observations, you see.
So this, well, you're in a bit of a trouble because you were basing on unpublished data, basically.
That's right, yeah.
But now, so there was argument about the fact that you hadn't given enough evidence for it.
Right.
But let's go back, though, to your, and I gather that you and Reber agreed on this, although you had separate papers, the idea of a coronal component from your 64 minimum observations.
Let's say that that came out of the theoretical analysis of the way the sidereal profiles, intensity versus sidereal time, change with frequency, and these required a model which had a disk-like emission and absorption on which was superimposed a halo-like distribution of emission but not absorption. So you had absorption in the disk and emission elsewhere and in the disk, and this wasn't put out as a way of promoting a halo or anything else. It came out of the observations directly and couldn't be avoided, and it was published like that, without, mm-hmm, almost without comment.
Yes.
Simply because I was told that it wasn't acceptable if it had been commented
so
on.
So the word halo was verboten.
Right.
Yeah. And so why was it verboten? I mean,
I don't know. I never could
follow. You weren't
this
part of that. In the
all way. I know is I sort of showed all this stuff to Bernie Mills, and he wouldn't have it on at any price.
Okay.
So I tend to have had this experience sort of periodically that I make observations and publish them and then find that for various reasons they're not acceptable, and rather than do what I consider to be beating my head against a brick wall, I much prefer to drop that particular topic and go on to other things in the sense that I've worked in ionospheric physics and magnetospheric physics, and the problems of Jupiter in solar physics, mm-hmm, and galactic radio astronomy. And in effect, I shuffle these round, and when things get too hot in one branch, I go on to the next one and let them sort themselves out over a period of 3 or 4 years, and then maybe come back to
You're
it.
Confident in your observations and that they will eventually stand by themselves. Yeah. One final question I'd be interested to ask you, if you'd be willing to comment, is since you have worked with Grote Reber, and one, are really one of the few people that have, in a sense, since he, of course, is an independent soul, to say the least, would you comment on what you think are really the characteristics that led him to make, of course, the really big breakthroughs in the late 30s and early 40s, and then still to do good things and later on?
I think he had tremendous persistence in the face of adversity, in a sense, that he would not allow himself to be beaten by any problem. He wouldn't be put off.
Be it technical or political or anything else, financial. No, I have to agree with you on that.
And this is the crucial quality that's needed to establish anything new, as he did,
mm-hmm.
because before it's established, you can't know that there's anything there. You have to persist, even when you don't get any results.
Yeah, and people are going to be saying it's not worthwhile because...
I mean, the same sorts of things are going on now, of course, say in gravitational wave astronomy. People are having to persist into this.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's rather analogous, curiously enough, to radio astronomy in the 1890s.
Yeah, that's right.
You have detectors which everyone can tell you are at many orders of magnitude too insensitive. I mean, in a way, the detectors are absurd.
Mm-hmm.
Large cylinders of aluminium weighing several tons, mm-hmm. able to detect something like sort of 10 to the minus 6 watts per square meter, per hertz or something like that. And yet the radio signals that we get are, say, 10 to the minus 26 watts. It's rather like trying to detect radio signals with a coherer,
mm-hmm.
which would have about the same sensitivity
right.
as the gravitational wave detectors.
There might be a chance if you got a really big burst and everything was just right, but
this is right.
Probably it's going to take a decade or two or three or who knows.
Yeah. Yes, I think people are starting to zero in on techniques which will increase the sensitivity very much. Cryogenic. All this sort mm-hmm. of thing, able to detect displacements of 10 to the minus 19 centimeters, much smaller than a radius of an electron, actually, all this sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't it true that low-frequency radio astronomy is still today, I mean, looked upon as by most radio astronomers as sort of by the way that it...
Oh, yes.
I mean, you have to persist.
No, I think it's... It's one end of the spectrum. It's a large end on a logarithmic scale. And say if you take the bit from, say, 1,000, from 100 megahertz down to, say, 1 megahertz, then there's two orders of magnitude. And it's about the same amount as from 100 megahertz to 10,000 megahertz, which is the main radio astronomy band. So from that point of view, I'm sure there's a lot of information there, but the difficulties of making the observations are so great that... It has to be a rather peripheral branch of the subject. Below about 25 megahertz, it's really impossible. Compared with making observations up, say, 1,000 megahertz
mm-hmm.
or so.
So you think it's just mainly the difficulty, not that people don't recognize the value of the data?
Well, I think if you are able to make observations as we can here with a very favorable geographical situation,
mm-hmm.
And which then cannot easily be made anywhere else, you're in the unfortunate situation of not having enough international feedback to keep the thing interesting to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And it would only be if some particularly wild and way out discovery were made, like pulsars, that it
right.
would concentrate attention.
Right.
Working in a sense where you're the only, owing to favourable circumstances, the only person able to make the observations is a very unsatisfactory situation to be in.
Hmm. That's an interesting comment. So you also seem to be implying that people working at high frequencies cannot profit from what you observe at the low frequencies and thereby change their observing programs. Their research objectives.
Yeah, I'd say this is
because the phenomena you're seeing are
different.
Are really quite different.
Yeah, the same thing applies to the Jupiter signals.
Yeah, of course, there they they really do just cut off at one frequency.
They cut off at 40 megahertz, and I think the problem is essentially that one is dealing with a very complicated magnetosphere with what are essentially insufficient techniques of observation. And a fair analogy is that of the study of the Earth's magnetosphere, which has now been going on since the middle 50s. And I think, although the broad picture is pretty well understood now, the mechanisms and the theories of all the detailed emissions, both particle and electromagnetic, are still being worked out.
Are you speaking for the Earth now?
Yes, the Earth. I'm just saying.
Even for the Earth,
20 years of work into the Earth's magnetosphere.
By a far greater number of people than working
on. Has still left an enormous number of questions unanswered, and I think the Jupiter thing will really be in the 21st century before it's sorted out.
Yeah. Well, okay. Thank you very much.
The interview with Bill Ellis on 10 March 78.